Welcome. This is Why Life Is, and I'm your host, Niles McFlower. We have another great show tonight dealing with metaphysics and spirituality and a number of other related subjects, I would say. Tonight I thought that we would deal with a kind of a play on words. We're going to deal with death, taxes, and the astral world. Yeah. And a lot of you are saying, how do you put those together, and doesn't it mean the inevitability of life itself? Yes. It's not the only inevitability, but it certainly has a lot to do with that concept. So if you figured that part out beforehand, if you saw what the title was going to be for tonight's show, great for you. If not, well, now you know. If you would like to call in and give your 2 cents worth or whatever, ask a question, make a comment, however you want to put it, you can call in at 877-876-5227 in the U.S. For those of you calling from Canada, try 888-815-9756. I know we have some people who live in Europe, and I don't have a number for you that's toll-free, but you still can call if you want. I just want you to know that. And also people living in other parts of the world. Actually, it could be many dozens of countries at this point. But besides those people who are living there, and anywhere for that matter, we are all inevitably going to be not only paying taxes, I guess. I guess there's a few people who want to try to get away with that idea, but generally speaking, there are bad karmic consequences, if not, we'll say, more human consequences. We all are going to die in the sense that we will use up the physical body that we are presently living in, but that doesn't mean our consciousness dies. It just means that the body that we use to perceive an environment, the environment being the etheric physical world or the electromagnetic part of the physical world, as well as the physical world, is at this time no longer available to us to perceive if our body is gone. So we need to have the body while we're here, and then once the body's gone, we can't any longer stay in this world, which is okay, because there's another place to go to, and that's the last part of what we've been talking about, the astral world. A lot of people say, well, what's that astral about? Well, it's really about a world in which energy has more than the three kinds of dimensionality to it that we are familiar with. That means the forms actually have an additional way or, we'll say, expression to themselves. And the expression has to do with the direction and the movement or speed of energy. And you might say, well, I don't understand that. Well, that's okay. I'll explain it to you. In this dimension, energy just kind of sits wherever you put it. And it isn't necessarily moving in any particular direction within a desk or a chair or anything that you might handle within your own physical bodies. The energy that is in it is randomly moving around. It is not moving in any specific direction whatsoever. It is just literally kind of bouncing around from one molecule to another, from one within an atom. Parts of an atom are moving around. There is not any specific direction until you get down to literally the subatomic level. And actually, at that point, there is, but there's a reason for that, and I won't go into it tonight. But for those of you who want to know more, you can always email me, or you can call me, and I'll explain why. But at any rate, so in this dimension, because of a thing called inertia, there's so much gravity that things get really held down tight. Energy, at most, can be chaotic within itself, but it doesn't follow a specific direction. And it doesn't have a continuous speed to itself. Oftentimes, its speed is constantly changing from one speed to another, to another, to another. It's not the kind of thing you would call consistent or constant. Whereas, in this other dimension of time and space we call the astral world, and other dimensions beyond that dimension, the thing that's kind of neat about energy is that it can be focused by just thought itself, because there's very little gravity holding it down, and there's a thing called a quantum constant that is so much bigger, it causes energy to follow thought a lot better. Now, this is physics. What I'm telling you right now is not metaphysics. And so, consequently, if we think a certain thing, particularly using our imagination, we can literally create forms in the astral world that you can't do here, not really. Although I know a lot of people think that maybe possibly do it here, but in actuality, it isn't. And so this added dimension to energy itself and the fact that it is at a much higher frequency in a different phase than here, it all comes together to allow energy to do remarkable things and to do it with just the focus of our own thought on it. Amazing stuff. And so energy really creates a whole new dimensionality in itself from the changes in physics. It allows us to be able to convert most of our desires into reality without taking a great deal of effort in the process. In order to convert our desires in the physical world where we live right now, it takes amazing amounts of effort to get even a small amount of what we might call our desires to be met. Now, I'm not, this is not a statement that meeting all of one's desires is a great thing. Actually, there's some serious issues about that. But I'm just explaining how it works for those of you who have had questions about that in the past. Now, there's another interesting little twist to this whole subject about inevitability. The bodies that we use here are kind of more, they're dense, and they have a lack of fine-tunedness to their senses. So our senses in this realm work okay. They work great for sensing physical things. But because they aren't fine-tuned and because they aren't very subtle, they really can't sense much else. So that's the reason why most people who may be listening to me right now say, well, I don't know anything about this astral world. Well, the reason you don't is because, well, although you still have an astral body, so to speak, you don't use it much except to have certain kinds of emotional feelings. But you don't really sense almost anything of the astral world directly while you're physically alive because your physical senses literally drown out almost all sense that would give you an ability to be able to sense what this astral world is about. So the inevitability is that we are all going to find out about it. I promise that is the case. But at the present time, most people don't necessarily believe it exists. And even if they do, they have little comprehension, unless they've been listening into this program or some others by other people, or if they have been reading books such as I have written or others have written on the subject, or if they have had the unique experiences, almost unique, of doing significant amounts of astral traveling, that means being fully conscious outside of their physical body, while leaving their physical body and senses here, and then consciously applying a focus of their attention into their astral senses and body, which allows them to then go and live for brief periods of time, relatively, in the astral world and to discover more of what I'm saying. Now, some people have asked me over time, sometimes, how come, particularly on these shows, the radio shows, you don't say almost anything about yourself? Well, I kind of think that that's a role of a teacher is to talk about things outside of ourselves. If you really want to know a lot about me, you can drop me a line. I'll be glad to have a discussion or whatever. But the point is that in this venue, I kind of think of it as a process of helping others to understand, not necessarily about me or anyone specifically, but about the concepts of how the universe works or could work and much more. Therefore, trying to talk about myself is really kind of mostly antithetical to that. However, here's a little zinger. Tonight, I'm going to do a little talking about it because it applies to what I said a minute ago, that if a person has actually had experiences in going to the astral world, it gives them some authority in the experience itself to talk about the subject. And it's why I am here, really right now, talking to all of you out there. It's not because I've read about, nor because I was taught by others about, this vast field, although I have. been, in both cases, read and been taught by others. But that isn't the reason that I'm here doing this. It's because of experiences that I had a long time ago in the beginning and continuing really somewhat to the present that deals with other dimensions of time and space, not just the astral world, although primarily so, certainly if we go back to the 1970s. Now, let me tell you about the 1970s. Some of you say, oh, the 1970s, is he really that old? Yes, I know. I'm dating myself again. But back in the 70s, I was director of a mental health institute. This institute, besides providing outpatient services to people who had certain types of emotional or mental problems and sometimes counseling issues, dealing with relationship problems, etc., it also offered a wide variety of opportunities, some of which were for what some people called encounter groups. We call them personal growth groups. Ways that people could get together and discover more about who they were through hearing how others were, that kind of thing. Not really a therapy model, more of a growth model. And besides that, the Institute also operated somewhat under grants. Not all of its money came from grants, but a lot did, and the grants sometimes went for research projects. And one of the projects was to determine the state of consciousness that people might possess or have while they were in a very unusual environment, referred to as an isolation tank. Some people call it a sensory isolation tank. And some people, although this was not the word we used, referred to them back in those days in the mid-70s as deprivation tanks. The negativity of that word was avoided by those who worked within the Institute because they thought that it colored the overall experiences that people might have who use this particular device. Now, in this particular one that we had, this isolation tank, people were at really the experience of true zero gravity. And once a person is completely isolated from their environment and they don't experience a sensation of gravity, which is a big deal, the focus of their consciousness quickly changes from their physical body to the more subtle bodies, and particularly the astral body, which leads to a thing called out-of-body experience or astral travel. And that was something I didn't believe in at the time. Yeah, I was director of the Institute. I was not head. I was not the head of this particular research project. There was another doctor, a guy who had gone to school in, Princeton, and had participated in some experiments there and come out here and wanted to run an experiment at our place, and he did. And during his tenure, I got finally, after some reluctance, some opportunity of going into this environment, and I myself started to have experiences that we could only call out-of-body. Yep, I was floating around in the tank, and the next thing you knew, I was in another dimension of time and space. Now, for those of you who are thinking that maybe I was asleep, or maybe I was having some kind of hallucinatory, crazy experience, I and many other people that went into this environment were hooked up to two different kinds of EEG machines. And these EEG machines could prove, and they did prove, that we were neither asleep nor were we having some kind of, we'll call it, traumatic hallucinatory experience, but we were having an altered state of consciousness, which could not be explained in terms of normal psychological terms. So we have some empirical evidence to support the fact that those kind of things weren't happening, but rather what was happening was we were having experiences in another time and place, in space, another dimension. Okay, I'm saying we because many people went in there besides myself. I went in pretty tardied. I went in fairly late in the experiment, and when I started, I had not a high level of confidence in what might happen because I had a lot of doubts about it. But I soon, very soon, changed my mind. I sort of became the Studs Terkel of the next dimension, the astral world, trying to understand and asking people we would call dead people, but they really were alive there, what was going on. And I wanted to learn much more about physics, because I was very interested in physics at the time. Although psychology was the last training that I had, I was really more interested in physics, actually. And it had a great ring for me, because I wanted to understand how the universe worked. And this really opened up a whole new field for me, because I could ask people and to do experiments and actually literally have a whole laboratory of another world to explore to find out how the physics of that world were different from the physics of where we are right now. And, of course, I very quickly became a believer in life after death, and way beyond that, I became much more spiritually inclined and more interested in understanding maybe there was a creator to the universe and there was something behind all of this than just a, we'll call it, an accident or a matter of chance that things were the way they were. It became quite clear to me there was a rational reason for the whole experience I was having was designed to be like that. Now, that was a big shock for me, anyway. And then I also was encouraged, because of those experiences, to read other people's books and papers and listen to what they had to say, and eventually went to people who taught me various ideas. So it kind of like changed my life. It was truly an experience that created a new path for me to take. At any rate, because of those experiences, I can talk with some authority. I'm not saying I know everything, and I'm not saying that some of the things that I experienced aren't a fabric of my own creation, because one of the dangers of this other time and place that we live in after our physical death is that reality can be altered much more easily, and the world created much more so than the one we presently live in, just through our own creative imagination. So we do have to be careful. I do have to be careful to check out that the experiences I had were not unique to my own imagination, but rather were around me in a kind of ubiquitous way, rather than something that was a one-time experience, something that I may have created. Those kinds of experiences are the things I don't teach about, because I'm not so sure about them. The things that were all the time going on, those I have a much higher level of confidence in, that they are the reality of the next world. The inevitability of going to the astral world also suggests that if people here knew where they were going to and why, they might live a bit differently while they're here, particularly if they understood, and I eventually think I did figure out, why everything is the way it is, or at least many things are, and that there is really a creator or God who has designed this with purposes in mind. And if we understand those purposes, and even better, if we co-create within them, there is a great benefit, tremendous benefit, to all of us in that process. The getting over the fear of death in itself is amazing. No matter how old you are, although the older you get, the more this may make some sense, the inevitability of death becomes, if not a fear, a sense of doom. Because if a person does not believe they're going on to another dimension to live within, at least in consciousness, they're going to leave a body here, but they'll still have a body. Resembles pretty closely the body they had here, because you're creating mostly what it looks like. But at any rate, they're going to pretty much be who they are here, only a better version. They're going to be more sensitive, more aware, which improves consciousness in a realm in which they will have much less fear of death, because they've already been there, done that, and know that even when they leave that dimension for another dimension, which is even more subtle, the same thing's probably going to happen. They're not going to die. Now, they also eventually learn, although not necessarily directly in the astral world experience, but more in the monastic or mental world experience, that they're going to eventually go back to a state of being part of a soul that they are separated from while they're in this journey that the soul can't take, because it can't wear the bodies and senses that we take on as human beings. And that journey allows us to co-create with our Creator in dimensions of time and space a soul could not be in. It has to send an emissary, us, to go do something about it. That's the amazing thing about it. I love that whole scenario. It's just amazing. As I discovered that scenario, it changed my life. Because I began to realize, well, heck, I'm really here for something big. I mean, so is everybody else. It wasn't just about me, of course. It was about the way the whole system worked. And I began to see how it all fit together. And that obviously this wasn't a random act of nature. This was created by a being who had a great deal of understanding and even more possibly purpose than we could ever really fully comprehend. Life itself, and that's what this program is about, why life is really an extension of this being's desire to grow. And its method of growth is for it to create life that is free to either co-create with it or create anything else it seeks to. The freedom of life allows there to be freedom of thought and freedom of expression, which allows life to alter or change the very nature of its own creator. And the creator wants that because the creator wants to grow in ways that are not like a puppet show. It doesn't want life to just be some extension of its own processes, with there being nothing interesting, nothing new, complete boredom, of course. It doesn't seek that. As a matter of fact, it seeks the exact opposite. This allows strange things to take place, sometimes undesirable things. But it also allows growth, and growth is a big, big deal. Growth through freedom, and growth through choice, growth through separation to some extent from our own creator, with us then, we'll say, choosing, if we see so do, by making great efforts at times, to be a co-creator with that creator. This is the reason, one of the reasons we exist, and it's so amazing. Well, at any rate, I know I can talk about that ad infinitum if I really chose to, but I think the important thing here is that this changes the perception of people once they have enough understanding of it and maybe some experience with it. Now, I'm not suggesting that everybody start doing some types of meditation to try to leave their body, but if you had one of them, if everybody had one of them, I think the world would be a very different place. Most people would quickly change the direction of their life, and creating more of virtue or light in form would be at the top of their list rather than, well, maybe I'll get around to that someday, because they would realize that's what they really came here for. It would be an awakening experience. Now, you might say, well, why doesn't everybody do that? Well, because before you would even contemplate such a thing, you would need to have a considerable level of, I'll call it belief, or more likely some intuitive understanding that there's possibly some truth to what I'm saying beyond just what you may have read or listened to. It's got to be deeper inside of you. Most people otherwise wouldn't spend the 6 to 8 weeks it takes usually to have a single out-of-body experience, which usually doesn't get you to the astral world, but at least you leave the physical body, you kind of float around in the electromagnetic or etheric part of this dimension. Just that alone is a life-changing experience. Getting to the astral world can be months of time, and it isn't always pleasant because there are parts of the astral world that aren't all that great, where some people exist that are fairly low in consciousness, and the first few times or more that a person goes to the astral world, if they have out-of-body experiences, they oftentimes visit those parts because they're usually there for reasons which are not truly altruistic. They're there more for, well, gee, I'd really get a kick out of trying this thing, you know. Well, those kinds of desires don't put you in a place around people who are really there to be of service to others. Okay, so the inevitability of our own traveling eventually to the astral world causes us to unfortunately live with a sense of doom at times. All of us do travel to the astral world, but only in a semi or subconscious state while we dream. Unfortunately, because our self structure is not well formed, during the dreaming process, even during the most lucid of dreams, this is true. The results are oftentimes that we don't buy into that there's a reality to this other dimension. The dreams themselves are so disjointed and difficult to remember and understand, and the things that take place in them, since most of them are self-created, don't seem to really involve reality. And that's the truth. They're not that involved with reality. And so consequently, they could convince us that if this dream world has anything to do with where we're going to, it's a bunch of nonsense. Well, dreams are dreams, and full conscious experience of the astral world is a totally different animal. Okay, well, what's the whole point of all of this? The point is that in order for us to get through the idea that death is not finality in consciousness, we need to look deeper inside both ourselves and into the reality of the world we're presently living in, and read about people's experiences such as mine, and hear about those experiences, so that it could stimulate within us the ability to perceive something that is perceivable, but just barely, if we choose to. The way we can perceive it is that we can see within the world we live, the physical world, that there are still elements of God around us, and there are still reasons for us to not hold on to a sense of doom about death. And it doesn't matter if a person's highly religious or not. Religion does not seem to be a way to inoculate people out of the fear of death. It only gives them some hope that if religion is right, they're going to be okay. Most people really don't completely let go of the fear of death. Now, I can prove that, but I don't want to go into the details, possibly because it could be misused. I'm just saying this for other people to consider and to think about. There are ways to prove it, but I'd rather not talk about those. So it is something to consider. And when we get back from break, I want to talk about the question of how religion can help, besides, as I just said, it sometimes may not help, us deal with the question of death and maybe taxes, but certainly the astral world, and how it still plays a role, even in the astral world. I don't want you to all think that I am a-religious or non-religious. That's certainly not the case. It's just that my perspective on things may be considerably different. So we'll talk about this when we come back from break in about 2.5 minutes.
Hun, what book are you reading?
It's a novel, kind of, about romance, love, and spiritual life in general.
Kind of a novel? What do you mean?
Well, it's based on some real-life experiences and even real characters. Some of their experiences are fascinating and remarkable. I can't put this book down.
How come the title is Afterlife Love?
That's part of the fascination. This book describes the afterlife in intricate detail and even explains why things are the way they're explained.
But how can anyone write about or know that?
Some of the characters travel out of body to some places that people who've already died also go to. I'm finding it completely believable because it all makes sense and fits into a bigger picture for me.
Hun, what happens to these people?
You can read it for yourself when I'm done if you want.
Better yet, I'll get my own copy so we can discuss it while we read. Let me see. I'll write down the title. It's Afterlife Love by Niles McFlower. M-A-C-F-L-O-U-E-R.
Afterlife Love is available in some bookstores and from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com or 480-966-3132. That's 480-966-3132.
Hi, everyone. Since childhood, I've had questions about my life and life in general that I couldn't find adequate answers to. Questions like, why am I here? Why are others here? Does the universe have a purpose? And how does that relate to my life? More recently, I've been wondering what happens when we die, especially the reasons why. I'm more of a doubter than a believer in many things, and answers that include the whys allow me to think and figure out the truth for myself. I've been reading a book, Life's Hidden Meaning. This one book contains more answers, including the wise, than all other sources I've read or heard. It's amazing to me that every one of my questions has been thoroughly answered. More importantly, I have found that all of these answers so far have checked out to be true. I hope this message helps some of you in your quest for better understanding. The name of this wonderful book is, again, Life's Hidden Meaning by metaphysician Niles McFlower. Some bookstores sell it. I got my copy directly from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com. Life's Hidden Meaning may enlighten your mind and bring some peace and joy to your heart.
We're back. This is Why Life Is, and I'm your host, Niles McFlower. Hope you heard the first half of the show, and if you haven't, well, you'll be able to fill in the blanks, I think, as we continue on. As I ended, I was saying that religion can play an important role in people dealing with the inevitable, which death, taxes, and the astral world are certainly inevitable. I think it's important to also recognize that some religions do not, of course, espouse any of the things I'm talking about. I mean, I don't want to in any way disregard or try to disparage that fact. I am only saying what I know to be reality for me, and of course I'm not trying to convince anybody else that they have to hear or believe this reality. If you're tuned in, it's because you're choosing to, and if you want to say something different, call 877-876-5227 if you're in the U.S. and let me know about it. But, you know, I'm going to continue on now talking about this question of religion. Religion is, to me, proof there is a God. You might say, well, come on. Isn't the whole point of religion it can't be proved? Actually, religion is proof of God in itself, and I'll explain how. I want you to think about this, and especially for those of you who are very entrenched in evolutionary Darwinian thought, which is great, because I very much believe that evolution is a method that God has chosen to grow life in many different ways on this planet and probably many others. But this is the concept I want you to think about. Have you ever seen, and you let me know if you have, because I haven't heard anybody answer this question in an affirmative way. Have you ever seen any animals, or plants for that matter, but if you've seen some plants, then let me know about that too, that are gathering together for the sake of understanding and praying to their creator, are building churches or buildings for the sake of doing so, are trying to preserve all life, not just the life of animals similar to themselves, even if they are of different species, but in some way they recognize them as animals, but nonetheless, not because they experience their creator, but because they experience the other animal, which is fine. That's called love of animals, and animals love each other, and they should, and they can. But I'm talking about loving God. Have you ever experienced a plant or an animal, or anything else for that matter, besides a human being, that loves God? And you see, here's the point. We created religions. I don't believe God created religions. I believe humans create religions. I think God created the opportunity through our senses to sense some element of itself, of God, or the Creator, or whatever name you prefer to use. And since we have that in our nature, different from animals and plants, we choose to then create religions. That's why religions are proof that God exists. Think about that. If we are only about 1.6% or less different from some orangutans or chimpanzees, and if we have most of the characteristics, in some cases, of some animals, including brain sizes in some extreme cases, and we have sometimes less senses of our five senses than many animals have, what sets us apart? Many people question this, and some evolutionary biologists claim we're not apart. We're just in a little bit of an extension. Well, then there's the God thing, you see. We perceive our own creator in life itself. And in our life, but in the life of many other things besides human life and in other human beings as well. We respect this life sometimes. We take care of it sometimes. We can be great stewards and great destroyers of it. But regardless of all of those factors, the fact that we can just recognize that life is an expression of a creator is what makes the proof of the creator's existence and the proof that religion is proof of that as well. So the most important thing to me about religion is that it exists, and it exists ubiquitously among almost every society wherever you find human beings. Now, does that mean every human being is religious? Of course not. If it were, then there would be another problem, because it would mean that there was some kind of cookie-cutter process to creating human life in which there would be no free choice. The thing that also proves to me that the Creator or God chose to grow itself by providing freedom of thought and expression or action to humans and almost all other forms of life at some level is by the very fact of what I just explained. It's self-evident by logic. It isn't self-evident because I have to have faith, although there's nothing wrong with faith, but it is self-evident because of reason and logic. And that's what makes it so exciting, is that you can approach this from different angles. You don't have to just be in a faith-only perspective. Even if you, and some of you are, very, very religious, and you have a particular doctrine and specific way of interpreting what life is and how your life fits into the rest of life and to the process, the inevitable process of dying, it doesn't matter, because the agreement we must have, you, I, and all other people, is that we have the capability of seeing and expressing God, and we have the ability, amazingly, if we so choose, to ignore that expression, to ignore that there is a God, and to conclude that there isn't, which even makes it more likely that there is, because that's how God could grow, and God couldn't grow if we couldn't do that. Wow. Think about that. Now, I know that's a mouthful, and some people say I get very heady sometimes. It's hard to follow what I'm saying. I know. But these are concepts that are so big, and they so explain much of how the universe works, that this, to me, is, like, worth talking a lot about. It really is. And it has a lot to do with the inevitability of dying. Because for a lot of people, the expression I hear, now I talk to some people on occasion that have great fear and worry about death. Sometimes what they fear is that they have lived a life that is not exemplary, and they don't think that it's going to be very good for them when they die. Partly because maybe the religion that they have been following suggest that, and partly because they don't feel very good about themselves. You see, here's the interesting thing about this. If a person chooses to live a relatively negative and hostile to other life, they can change. And in the process of dying, the good news is there's a thing called what I call it. I'll call it metaphysical grace, because to me, religious grace comes through faith, and metaphysical grace comes from understanding that upon death from the physical world, a person naturally becomes more aware and therefore more conscious and more capable of living a better life than they live while they are physically alive. We're actually immediately rewarded for the fact that we spend a very difficult time in a very difficult part of the universe, the most difficult. I call it the basement. Welcome to the basement, the physical universe. And in this basement, we kind of thrash around. Most of the time, it's like with the lights off, so we're really in the darkness. We are in great illusion, and we make terrible mistakes. We do bad things sometimes. We may regret them while we're here, and we almost certainly will regret them at some time in the future in other places, other dimensions of time and space that are more subtle and easier to live in and that allow us to perceive our Creator so much more that we cease living as selfishly and self-focused as we do while we're physically alive. That is the metaphysical grace I'm talking about. You can gain some of that grace just through faith, and you can have a sense of it. The difference is that having a sense of it just through faith oftentimes leads some people into a relatively cynical and self-indulgent nature about their belief in it. And this is a concern I have, that some people follow various tenets in various religions that say that unless their faith is the one that's followed, their faith in grace or faith in God is the one that's followed, that all others are going to suffer some dire, severe consequences. And that, to me, would again be antithetical to the nature of the God that I have experienced, both while physically alive and in traveling to other dimensions of time and space. So it just doesn't work for me. But I don't condemn it. I am only saying what doesn't work for me because I think the more metaphysical explanation combined with some elements of faith produce a more rounded and a less gloomy side to the death process. Let me explain. Let's assume for a minute that I'm into a specific form of religion or thought process that says that only people who go to a certain location and say certain words and read certain things and have contact with other people who do the same thing and are in some way given blessings or given some kind of whatever, only those that do this with me are going to enjoy and have some kind of afterlife that is welcome and healthy and great. And the rest are going to not do so well. And most of them are going to suffer dire consequences because they didn't get it. They didn't get that my way is the highway. My way is not the highway. My way is the way, and everybody else can take the highway, which is the bad way. So if I think that, I'm so separated from most other people, and this is the truth, I have now elected to remove myself from probably 99.9% of the rest of the people on the planet, and I have put myself in a position where there is a nagging doubt. I'm going to say this as I believe it to be true. I'm not saying that this is necessarily the case, but it would be for me. There would be a nagging doubt that this very structure of thought process has some very serious questionable flaws to it, and I would start questioning, although I would be maybe afraid to, that this may not be all what it's cracked up to be. Maybe it's not true. And if it's not true, then there may be nothing. So I would be constantly battling the nothingness to hold on to my faith. It's sort of like, and then I might project that nothingness onto everybody else and like be angry at them in some way or in a hostile or have a negative feeling if they don't accept or come over to my side because I need constant reaffirmation of my side or I feel the doom and gloom of nothingness. And that's what I see sometimes happening with some people who have that thought process. That troubles me. It troubles me for their sake. It doesn't trouble me for anything dealing with me. It troubles me for the fact that we're all connected together. And if they're experiencing that, their life has a lot of drag, a lot of issues. Things trouble them. And that's a problem. And most of the troubling is subconscious. I don't believe they consciously entertain these issues I'm talking about, which is the reason I'm talking about them tonight. I'm bringing them out in the open. I know they're controversial, and some of you might be angry at me. I'll probably get some emails about this. But it's okay. And you can call in and say, well, you son of a gun, you're saying this and that on the air. I don't like what you're saying. It's okay. You can say that. If you want to call up and say, I'm not going to argue with you. This isn't, I'm not into a challenge here. If you want to give a different opinion, you can. you're welcome to. But nonetheless, I'm explaining what concerns me. What concerns me are these negative results that can come about to some people. I'm not saying everybody that goes through this experience that I just described necessarily comes to the same results, but a lot of people do. And they spend time repressing the fact that they may not be right. They spend the time having to try to get other people to believe their stuff, because if they don't get them to, they are threatened by their own disbelief of it to some level. Now, they may not ever admit this. I'm not saying that this is something they're going to be, oh, it's fully conscious and they know what I'm saying. No, I'm only talking about it in a general term, and I'm only saying that maybe some people this happens to. But it is enough to be concerned about, and that's part of the people out there who I worry about. I will also worry about people who are some of them call themselves natural humanitarians or humanists, and they believe that there is no God. Okay, they say that there's no reason to believe in God because everything can be explained in some fashion other than having to have a God. Many of them are evolutionary biologists, actually. But here's the point. If you really want to get into that perspective, if you think it's comfortable to accept the idea that there is no life after physical death, then that's a problem. Now, some people have the belief there's no God, but there's a continuing level of consciousness that goes on. And that's probably a little easier to live with, because then you don't feel the doom and gloom and the fears about physical death. And it's a lot easier to swallow. But I think the majority of people, from my experience in talking to a lot of people, that are atheistic or highly humanistic, as they may refer to themselves, those people are unfortunately locked into the structure or thought that it doesn't matter. Consciousness and all realm of existence ceases at physical death, and that's just it. And they're perfectly okay with that. Just cook them up for dinner or chop them up and throw them away. Or doesn't make any difference what you do, because they're gone and that's it. They just go to sleep, don't wake up, and that's it. No problem. But you see, there is a problem with that, because they're denying their two senses, the heart and crown chakra senses, that deal with their own creator. When people repress the awareness that comes from those senses, they miss a great deal of the beauty of life. They miss a great deal of the subtleties of enjoying life as something greater than what it is in a more, we'll say, mundane way of experience. And so a good deal of life is missing from those people's experience and from their experience of themselves. As a result, they oftentimes have great fears of death, because the personality, the subconscious part of ourselves, tends to be greatly afraid of death, because it doesn't understand it. And they can't gain an understanding of death without those two senses of the creator operating. And they're repressing them. They're blocking them. So that's the issue. Once you start blocking those senses, you lead yourself down a path that for many people leads into a perspective of repression of fear of death. And I mean to a significant level. Usually the people I talk to are cavalier about it. They say, oh, no problem. It's not any different than falling asleep every night. You just don't wake up. Well, the interesting thing is the reason they don't fear falling asleep every night is because they believe they are going to wake up. You see, that's the problem. And the personality, the subconscious part of ourselves, I call it the personality, seeks to want to believe that it will go on, even as it denies that belief, if it's a humanist or an atheist. It's a very contradictory position. And again, it screws people up in so many ways. It produces so much disinformation because almost everything that we are informed with through the remaining of our senses has to be tempered with God, with the Creator being part of the experience, or we're missing the most important element of why we're here. Life becomes more and more narrow, and the meaning of life becomes some small thing, literally. Even if it's to live a life that is, you know, to be creative and virtuous at some level that a person thinks is in accord with their overall belief structure, it doesn't help if you remove God, because the meanings that come from the things that I just said, which are the most possible meaning most people could get without God, are so minuscule compared to the meaning that a person gets once they understand the Creator and that they're part of this creation. An amazing change takes place. An amazing change. You know what? I've been talking and talking, and I'm out of time. Oh, no. I would love to talk more about this subject, but unfortunately, I can't. Oh, I also wanted to mention, hi, Kevin, if you're listening. Somebody I know said he was going to listen tonight, and he wanted me to say hello to him. I just did. Okay, so I want to mention on Sunday, I'm going to be talking about the karmic implications of the economic crisis. Yes, it's about the events going on around us in the world, and especially in our country. If you can, tune into 1170 AM. If you are anywhere in the Boston, Massachusetts, Providence, Rhode Island, northeastern part of the United States, if you aren't, you can listen to WDISAM.com, Internet Radio, and just listen to me then. And it's from 4 to 5 p.m. Eastern Time. Yes, you can listen in, and hopefully you will, because I think it's an interesting subject. It certainly is timely. The karmic implication of the economic crisis. Kind of fit in with some of the stuff I was talking to you about tonight. Maybe the inevitability issues come into play. Also, on December 1st, Mimi's going to be talking, and she's a member of a spiritual group I am a member of. She's going to be talking about the science of sexual energy over at Glendale Borders from 7 to 8:15 p.m., Borders Books and Music, over in Glendale in the Phoenix metropolitan area. If you happen to be in that area, come and visit. Yeah, and she would love for you to come and say hello, you know. I sometimes do show up at these events. I probably won't be at that one, but I will possibly be at the one next month at Borders in Fiesta Mall in Mesa, Fiesta Borders. So I'll probably be there next month. At least I was there this last month. Okay, so I want to conclude tonight's show by just explaining that if we're going to be open about this subject, which I hope you've experienced in me, we need to be open-minded, and we need to be respectful of everybody's positions on the question of the inevitability of death and where we're going after death. But I would like you to also consider and see how, if there are ways, to fit in some of the ways I explained with your own belief structure, your faith. See how it might fit or how it might not. I'm also available. You can call me, you can email me, whatever. I'm here. And for those of you who are too shy to call in during the show, which a lot of you are, I know that because you contacted me afterwards. But if you want to, you can even call in next time or call in on the show on Sunday. We can talk about this subject even then. I'm totally open to that idea. So I hope this has been somewhat eye-opening, somewhat helpful, and there will be a lot more on this subject and many others in the near future. And until then, this has been Niles McFlower for Why Life Is.